For Esme Dupriz, it started with waterproof mascara. Then there was shampoo. Basically, once she started looking around for chemicals known as PFAS, she realized they were everywhere. And when I say everywhere, I mean everywhere, including probably in Esme herself.
Researchers have found PFAS everywhere they've thought to look. You know, the umbilical cords of newborns in Taiwan, the breast milk of moms in Sweden, polar bears, even air and rainwater worldwide. One of the researchers told me that the last blood bank sample to not show some level of PFAS dates back to the Korean War in the early 1950s.
Oh my gosh.
If you are alive today, you have PFAS in you.
Esme is an investigative reporter. She says the problem with PFAS, which you might know as forever chemicals, is their durability.
Once a PFAS is made, it doesn't go away. So that means that once it gets in your body, once it gets in the soil, once it gets in the water, it just stays there. And because we have so many routes of exposure now to PFAS, they just keep piling up and piling up and piling up.
That pileup has been linked to all sorts of problems, from cancer to infertility to high cholesterol. Even worse, because these chemicals don't decompose, they simply slosh around, moving from our stuff to our bodies, to the soil and the water, and back again. That's why last week, the Biden administration took what seemed like a big step towards eliminating the forever chemical threat.
Today, for the first time ever, the Environmental Protection Agency set new federal standards on certain so-called forever chemicals in drinking water.
The EPA's new standards will require utilities to reduce certain forever chemicals to the lowest levels they can be reliably measured. And officials say this will reduce exposure for 100 million people and help prevent thousands of illnesses, including certain types of cancers. Now, advocates praise the move.
Do we want to know how much PFAS is all around us day in and day out? Like, do you want to know? It feels like once you know, you can't unknow it.
That's true. Once you know, you can't unknow it. These chemicals got added to so many products over the years, and there's no or very little requirement to disclose that necessarily. And that's part of the problem, though, that opacity. Like, if we don't know where these chemicals are, we don't know how to avoid them.
Once we know how saturated the world around us is by these chemicals, what's supposed to happen next?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of scientists and researchers want the government to take stronger action. I mean, there's even a movement underfoot to pressure the EPA, for example, to just ban PFAS chemicals outright.
How likely is that to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Today on the show, the forever chemical dilemma and why a big step by the EPA feels to so many like a half measure. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. So to start, can you just explain what are PFAS? Some people may know them as forever chemicals.
The name PFAS might make you think that it's just one chemical, right? But the word PFAS is short for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Now, that's a mouthful, but it's an enormous class of many thousands of man-made compounds. Like you said, they're sometimes called forever chemicals, and that's because they don't break down. They are incredibly persistent, and that's because they are made up of chains of carbon atoms bonded to fluorine atoms. And those carbon-fluorine bonds are super strong and super stable. So that's what makes them useful. That's why PFAS chemicals have become ubiquitous.
Because they repel water. They repel grease if they're in your pan. They
right.
repel all sorts of things.
They make eggs slide off your nonstick cookware. They help rain jackets and school uniforms and mascara to be waterproof. They're in carpets to make them stainproof. They can withstand high temperatures, so they're in firefighting foams to put out fires. They're in dental floss, food packaging, brake fluid, you name it. So they really are everywhere. And it would be, frankly, hard to live in modern day America and not come across things every day with PFAS in them.
When did these chemicals become so common?
PFAS have been around since the 1940s, but their application really took off in the decades that followed as companies realized how useful they were. And then they invented new versions and they began adding more and more of them to more consumer and industrial products throughout the global economy. So what that means is that PFAS are found today throughout modern manufacturing. It's not just consumer products. It's also things like semiconductors, medical devices, aircraft, solar panels. These are really a ubiquitous element of the modern economy today.
When did we start to realize they might not be so good for us?
Well, for decades, most of what was known about PFAS was kept secret by the companies that made them. That included evidence of risks to human health. But it's really been in the last decade that researchers have begun to research this, and the scientific research has really piled up, showing that certain PFAS compounds can be toxic, and thus that possibly all of them may be.
In recent decades, a number of lawsuits forced chemical giants like DuPont and 3M to come clean about how they've been using forever chemicals. DuPont, for example, was the inventor of Teflon, a compound that makes pans nonstick, and they began producing it en masse starting in the 1950s. At the time, it was made using a particularly dangerous kind of PFAS called PFOA, or PFOA.
This is a type of PFAS that sickened cows on a West Virginia farm downstream of a DuPont facility. And the cows got so sick that their teeth turned black, their organs turned green, their mouths frothed with thick white goo before the animals simply got deranged and then died. It's also what two DuPont employees worked with before giving birth to babies with disfigured faces, and what lab monkeys were fed before growing so ill they had to be euthanized. So even trace amounts of this one PFAS, PFOA, are so dangerous, the EPA now says, that no level in drinking water is safe. So this is a type of PFAS that had been made for decades, and DuPont, you know, worked quite hard for a long time to make sure that that kind of evidence of harm, you know, wasn't widely known, wasn't publicly known, and thus couldn't be acted on by the EPA or any other regulatory regime.
Eventually, the EPA got wise and banned PFOA outright. It is now one of the few PFAS that manufacturers cannot make anymore. But remember, these are forever chemicals. So the PFOA already in the environment, along with all the other kinds of PFAS, that is there for good and making its way inside our bodies. One study found that 97% of Americans registered some level of PFAS in their blood.
We can ingest them, we can inhale them, we can dermally absorb them. So they continue to accumulate in our bloodstreams. And because PFAS are used in so many applications, part of the problem is just that we're constantly being exposed in so many ways. So you have multiple exposure routes. And we have enough long-term data to link PFAS exposure to really bad things like cancers and birth defects and infertility. That doesn't mean that all PFAS compounds cause all of these things. There are thousands of these chemicals, and not all of them are going to act in the exact same ways. But the more alarming thing to me is that we just don't know. You know, PFAS aren't dangerous in the way a hot stove is. You don't touch them and they burn you immediately. There isn't that immediate evidence of acute harm. The harmful effects take time to show up. They can take years or even decades to manifest. So we're in a situation now where PFAS have become ubiquitous. They're all around us, but we don't know all of the negative consequences of that. And the data that we have so far is just not reassuring.
Has that lack of information become a kind of shield for the industry? Because I imagine if you don't have information that something is truly bad, it becomes harder for the government to step in and say, like, well, we can't make this anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, zooming out really broadly, part of the issue here is that our environmental laws are based on the presumption of innocence. The burden of proof is not generally on industry to prove that chemicals are safe. That really surprised me when I learned that. You know, prior to releasing a new drug, pharmaceutical companies, for example, they have to conduct clinical trials to prove that it's safe and effective. But when it comes to chemicals, industry is really more like the legal system. I mean, it's a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. So I heard David Michaels, the former head of OSHA, talk about this concept. He referred to that as the body in the morgue method. Like, by the time you can show a chemical is dangerous, that it's killing people, it's too late.
You wrote a really interesting article laying out how hard it is to eliminate PFAS from industrial processes. You focused on this one company, Enhanced Technologies. They'd come up with a way to make plastic bottles more impermeable using PFAS. Can you explain what they did just real quick?
Yeah, so the story began in 2020 when an ecologist and an attorney named Kyla Bennett made this discovery. There was a pesticide that the state was routinely spraying over her town in rural Massachusetts to prevent this rare but lethal mosquito-borne disease. And she discovered that the pesticide contained a number of PFAS compounds. Now, like I said, the vast majority of PFAS compounds are virtually unregulated, but some of the ones that she found in that pesticide were the exception. They were considered so dangerous that the EPA had effectively banned them and actually thought that they were no longer being manufactured at all. So the fact that she found them in this pesticide was a big deal. And then it became even more so when EPA scientists pinpointed the source of that contamination. It turned out the pesticide's manufacturer hadn't intentionally added the PFAS compounds. The PFAS compounds were leaching into the product, rather, from the walls of a special type of plastic container in which it came. And that came from this company called Enhanced Technologies.
And Enhanced Technologies wasn't just making containers for pesticides, right? They were making containers for all kinds of people using this process that created PFAS.
Absolutely. So the EPA kind of started looking into this. They learned, of this company called Enhanced Technologies. It's based in Houston. Most people have never heard of it. As I began digging, I learned that Enhanced, was 40 years old. It was owned by private equity. It makes things crucial to our everyday existence from 20 locations around the world. And it's long held a domestic monopoly on a process called post-mold fluorination. So this is a special process. It strengthens the barrier properties of plastic in order to prevent whatever is stored inside, like solvents, essential oils, other corrosive liquids, from leaking or leaching out. So the problem is that Enhanced's process of fluorination also results in the unintentional formation of numerous PFAS chemicals. And again, some of the worst ones at that. And those compounds can then leach into whatever fluid you're storing in the fluorinated plastic containers. And what my reporting revealed was that this problem goes far beyond mosquito spray. I mean, that is to say, fluorinated plastics are used throughout the economy. They are used to contain household cleaners, weed killers, shampoo, body wash, cosmetics, flavors, fragrances. Enhanced fluorinates hundreds of millions of items a year. It's not just consumer companies, it's water treatment chemical providers, medical disinfectant manufacturers. And they've been used by some of the world's biggest brands. So Estee Lauder, L'Oreal, BMW. Also, I learned in my reporting that food companies and large soda companies have utilized Enhance for decades.
Yikes. Did Enhance even know that it was creating this problem, but with this fluorination process?
Enhance claims that they did not know. Some people are skeptical of that claim, but Enhance certainly says that they did not know. The EPA didn't know. They had never even considered plastics to be a route of PFAS exposure before. So this discovery really led to a cascade of fallout. The EPA ordered Enhance to effectively stop fluorinated plastic. The government watchdog that Kyla Bennett works for sued Enhance. The DOJ sued Enhance. The EPA said again to Enhance, you must stop.
So was that? Did it stop?
Incredibly, Enhance simply said, no, we're not going to stop. We've built our entire business on this. We're going to change some things so the amount of PFAS we generate is less. But no, we're not going to stop. And they continue to fluorinate this day.
That seems insane.
Yeah, I mean, I remember kind of discussions with my editors and they kind of couldn't believe it either, but it's true. Enhance has really fought hard in court. And actually, just a few weeks ago, they scored a big legal victory in the Fifth Circuit. But it does really show, I think this whole story, this whole case shows how hard it is, even when the EPA has this stated mission to move to a PFAS-free future, and they know that a company is producing PFAS, it's still really hard under the laws as written sometimes to get a company to stop.
When we come back, what would it take to actually limit the damage from PFAS? We talked about how the Biden administration issued the first national PFAS drinking water standards last week. How are Biden's new water regulations supposed to work exactly?
They essentially require local utilities to begin testing drinking water for a handful of the worst of the worst PFAS compounds over the next few years. And if they find those compounds are present, they will have to treat that contaminated water.
And will treating the water just get rid of the PFAS? Because isn't it persistent?
There are various ways to filter out the PFAS. I think it gets harder when you're talking about destroying the PFAS, you know, like in the filters, but at least you can, there are ways to get it out of the water. And, you know, this new rule by the EPA, it's a big deal. When the agency first proposed these national limits on drinking water back in March of 2022, the head of the EPA, Michael Regan, said they would prevent thousands of deaths and reduce tens of thousands of serious PFAS-related illnesses.
You know, I'm struck by the fact that the EPA is only choosing to have this drinking water requirement for six chemicals when there are more than 10,000 PFAS chemicals that we know about. Is the idea to have just an indicator, like we only need to test for these six because it'll tell us what we need to know? Or is the agency going to miss something by only looking for a few chemicals at a time?
These tests are definitely going to miss a lot of PFAS. Part of the problem is we may just not have the science to back up, you know, a regulation around that chemical because data takes a long time to collect on non-harm. There are definitely people that will say that these rules don't go far enough. If there are 10 or 15,000 types of PFAS chemicals out there and these new water rules are aimed at regulating six of them, like that's a laughable drop in the bucket, right? There are plenty of people, again, pushing the EPA to ban PFAS outright, as in ban the entire class of chemicals, so we simply don't keep contributing to this existing and already enormous environmental load. But I'm not sure anyone is optimistic about that happening anytime in the U.S.
Yeah. I kind of wonder, hearing the story of what happened with enhanced technologies, whether creating drinking water standards is a way to get around chemical companies like Enhance slow walking their own accountability here.
So I actually spoke with Kyla Bennett yesterday about this. I mean, what she'll tell you is that, and she used to work at the EPA, Kyla Bennett thinks of it as the agency kind of doing one thing with the right hand and another with the left hand. I mean, she finds these new water regulations really hard to reconcile. The water rules say, for example, there is absolutely no safe level of consumption of PFOA. For example, that's that one, you know, really super toxic poster child PFAS. And yet when it comes to the presence of that same chemical in fluorinated plastic, the EPA hasn't taken as drastic of an action as it could. So to make a long story short, it's very frustrating for people like Kyla who watch this happen and say, you know, great, we're thrilled about the water regulations, but can you please act harder and faster on other routes of PFAS exposure so we don't even have them in our water to begin with?
Do you ever imagine like a world without PFAS and what it would look like? Because we've talked about how it's used in essential things and it's become so ubiquitous. Like this class of chemicals is just in everything. It's keeping your couch from getting stained. It's like keeping your pants crisp and, you know, not getting rumpled or stained. Like, is there something that would be lost in a world without PFAS?
I mean, the world would definitely be a different place without PFAS. Obviously, there are plenty of scientists and researchers that say it would be a better place, but PFAS have been around for decades. It's become this slow-moving disaster that's really wonky and scientific, but it's really important. So as I began poking around, I soon came across an article published in a scientific journal, and this single sentence just jumped out at me as if it was flashing in like bold red text on my screen. It said, quote, "PFAS in consumer products often are relatively easy to replace," end quote.
Whoa.
So I sat there and I said, wait, what? Alternatives to PFAS exist? I had no idea. It's just, so alternatives to PFAS exist? Yes. It's just that companies aren't using them. So we have an already enormous PFAS problem and companies are just continuing to voluntarily add to it. The answer is yes.
But it seems like that's the opposite of what a company who's making these chemicals would say. They'd say, like, we need this to make your firefighting foam, to make, like, your waterproof jacket, to make your pan, to make your mask, like, all kinds of things, but especially essential things, like things that keep you safe, things like medical devices.
Yeah, so certainly some companies are trying to move away from PFAS. Some companies, you know, are still sticking to them. You know, they often will deny the science. That's a common tactic of, you know, denying or downplaying the science, saying it can't be as bad as it is. Obviously, if a company is using PFAS or any toxic chemical and they don't have a legal or regulatory reason not to, and they're continuing to make money, you know, there's your answer. But that brings up a point about this idea of essential use. So it is impossible to undo the decades of human environmental exposure to PFAS, but it's also not too late to stop making the problem worse. And that's worth dwelling on for a moment. One way to do that is to categorize how essential various PFAS uses are and to identify alternatives. So that's actually what researchers have begun to do. One recent study, for example, looked at the use of PFAS in the production of semiconductors, and they decided that that was currently essential given the absence of suitable alternatives. But then you talk about the use of PFAS in bicycle lubricants or household cleaning products or waterproof mascara. Is that essential? No, because non-fluorinated alternatives exist and they're just as effective. So given their ubiquity, our exposure to PFAS today is inevitable. That doesn't have to be true going forward.
You know, as part of your reporting, you've mentioned this woman, Kyla Bennett, who you spent some time with. She's a scientist and attorney in Massachusetts. She worries that PFAS has made her sick, right?
Correct.
She's totally upended her life to try to avoid chemicals at this point, which is so interesting to me. Like, you talk about she makes her own vegan yogurt so that her food doesn't touch plastic. Like, she doesn't have carpets or curtains. She was agonizing over buying a new brand of butter because she didn't know if the paper around the butter somehow had PFAS in it. How did you leave your encounter with this woman? Because to me, it's almost like she knows too much, you know? But also, she's not wrong.
Yeah, and Kyla would freely admit that some people are going to hear that and think she sounds totally crazy, and sometimes she feels totally crazy. So after I left her house, I mean, I did change some things in my everyday life, and maybe they're small and meaningless, but it at least makes me feel a little bit better. You know, for example, you know, I use shampoo bars now instead of like a bottle of shampoo. And the benefit of that is, I mean, first of all, there's an environmental benefit. I mean, it's a lower footprint because it doesn't have the water and the packaging. But more importantly, the packaging. It's really hard to know if a package of shampoo is going to be made of fluorinated plastic or not. And so if I use a bar of shampoo, I just don't have to, you know, worry about it as much.
I could also see how it would make you mad that you have to be your own personal EPA.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is, I think, a wide misconception that just because things are legal, it means they're safe. And that's definitely not true. And so people really have to do their homework. It does really put a lot of the burden of protecting ourselves on us, as opposed to, you know, government authorities or regulatory agencies to protect us for us.
Esme, I'm really grateful for your time and for your reporting. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Esme DePriz is an independent investigative journalist. You can find more of her work at esmedepriz.com. And that's the show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here next time.